Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscawain. During his annual family get-together in Georgia, author Bruce Feiler felt like his family was falling apart on every level. His aging parents were struggling with health issues and managing their everyday affairs. Every one of his siblings faced their own family challenges, ranging from moody teenagers to tantruming toddlers. Feiler and his wife Linda were arguing over shared responsibilities in raising their twin daughters. And it got Feiler thinking. There has to be a better way, a set of fresh ideas and creative solutions for modern families. So Bruce Feiler traveled all over the country to speak with people who have figured things out for their families. And the result is his new book, The Secrets of Happy Families. Bruce, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I just was thinking that my first book was published over 20 years ago when I was on Radio Times, and I'm always thrilled to come back. So thank you for having me.
Great. Well, welcome back and happy to have you. Now, when you set out to write this book, you pretty much asked anybody but the traditional sources we turn to for family advice. And so you did not really speak to psychologists, to mental health people. Why not? How did you choose your experts?
Well, as you very kindly and deftly laid out at the beginning of this conversation, I was frustrated as a parent. I think that both my wife and I felt kind of lost, like the old rules no longer apply, but the new rules have yet to be written. And I think that parents, we felt, and I think a lot of parents feel, like we're in this straitjacket, like the only new ideas that we can implement with our families must come from what I call the family improvement industry, right? Shrinks and self-help gurus and other family, quote-unquote, experts. And yet, if you just look around in those ideas, kind of, they've had their say. Those ideas are stale, frankly. If one more person tells me to repeat what my child says, acknowledge their feelings, and, you know, it's like, ah! Whereas in every other realm of contemporary life, there are all these new ideas about making groups and teams work effectively, whether it's Silicon Valley or business or sports teams or the military or you know, the restaurant world. There's all these ideas. And I was like, they must be doing something with their families. They must be taking ideas from their worlds and putting them into play with their children. Let me go talk to them. Let me meet real families, find out what they're doing, and then we'll test drive these ideas at my house.
Now, when you say old rules, new rules, what are you talking about? What were the biggest frustrations and challenges in your own home at the time?
Well, I would say just first of all, the chaos, kind of the sheer chaos of getting through the day. I mean, I think there have been, if you want to pull the lens back to 30,000 feet, I think there have been basically two massive changes that have gone on in the American family. One is that moms have flooded into the workplace, thereby changing the dynamic of a generation or two ago. But the other thing that's happened is that dads have been flooding into parenting. And so you've got basically these two very large changes coupled with technology, right? So now we're dealing with kids with noses and devices, and also kind of the workplace and the rest of life kind of interrupting what was used to be sacred family time. So, you know, from our point of view, what did we face? We faced chaotic mornings. We faced children not wanting to listen to their parents. We faced the challenge of how do you teach kids values in a world that's moving so fast? How do you say some things are timeless in a 24/7 rapid-paced world?
And you also faced a serious illness after the birth of your daughters.
I was diagnosed with cancer when my daughters were three. We got through that with the introduction of a lot of people, kind of a village-like extended family. Today, I am cancer-free 5 years later. And you also mentioned my parents were aging, right? So that was another dynamic. I was spending at least an hour a day dealing long distance with my parents and their issues, right? So we were this classic members of the sandwich generation, squeezed in a way between aging parents and rising children. And I was like, you know what? I'm tired of all this parenting wars, right? Like, be strict like the Chinese, be lax like the French. It's like, I just wanted answers. I wanted to know what worked, and let's come up with our own playbook.
And one more thing before we get to the new rules, but
yeah, sure.
The joy goes missing is what a lot of families talk about, and we've seen all these studies about how unhappy parents are. So the joy kind of gets ground up between all these responsibilities, and you don't feel it as much.
Well, I will agree with that to a point. There's no doubt that one of the things that I found as we move into this conversation is that successful families do go out and play, and they do make time to make fun. It's not just adapting and talking and some of the things that I kept learning. But I want to push back a little bit on the idea that parents are not happy. There has been a tremendous amount of chatter about this and a tremendous amount of research. And what the research shows that in those early years, there's not a lot of happiness because, as you know, it's not a lot of fun. You know, you've got, you're up all night, you're working during the day, the challenges are immense. And yes, quote unquote, individual happiness clearly takes a dip in every survey. However, those same surveys show when you talk to parents, especially moms, about what is most meaningful in your life, that goes skyrocketing when they have children. So while individual happiness takes a dip, the sense of meaning rises, and over time, childless couples and couples with children converge around 7 or 8 years and have the same happiness level. So part of my message here is that the happiness movement has led us a little bit astray by just focusing on me, myself, my own happiness. The truth is, what we've learned in the first generation of positive psychology is that happiness is relationships. Happiness is other people, and the relationship that matters most to us is our family. And if we just take small steps to work on that, we can make everybody in the larger whole happier.
That's Bruce Feiler. He has written a new book, which is called The Secrets of Happy Families. He's a columnist for the New York Times and has written several books. And Bruce, you basically set out to find a better framework to make things function better, to get through the day without so much conflict and angst and annoyance. Does that sum it up pretty much?
Yeah, I wanted new rules. I wanted a new playbook. I wanted some ideas. I didn't want the 5 things that I had to do because those lists stress me out. Like, what if I disagree with number 2 or I can't remember number 4? I wanted a whole new rash of new ideas because the ones that work with my family might be different than the ones that work with your family. And you talk about framework, and I think that was really, kind of one of the first things I learned, right? Which is, I thought as a parent that you just set a few rules and you follow them. And it turns out that doesn't work. And the first thing I learned is that you have to change. You have to be adaptable, right? Just when your kids stop teething, they start tantrums. Just when they stop needing your help taking a bath, they need your help dealing with online bullying. And you need a framework. And there is a tremendous amount of research out there about how to be adaptable. We've put in a system in our lives based on what is kind of the new hot management technique that a lot of families are doing now. It's called Agile. And the idea is, instead of large projects that take years, you do things in small chunks, a week or two. So we have a weekly family meeting now, and we ask 3 questions. What went well in our family this week? What didn't work well? What will we agree to work on in the coming week? And then, and here's the key, we let our children pick their own rewards and punishments. This is based on cutting-edge research that shows that children who plan their own schedules, make their own list of the things they're going to do, basically evaluate their own work, they build up their prefrontal cortex and take greater control over our lives. So rather than us telling them what to do all the time, we in effect are co-creating our family. It's not lax, it's not anything goes, but we bring them in the process, let them practice developing the skills we want them to have later.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. And Bruce, you lay out that concept of agile families in your first chapter, which takes us to Idaho, and you visited the Starr family. They have 4 kids. Describe them a bit and how they made their family work.
Well, they were living in complete chaos, as their mom told me. And they have, I mean, my daughters are 8 now. They had 4 teenagers, right? And one of them has Asperger, one of them has ADHD, one of them is practicing lacrosse on the far side of town, and one of them is tutoring math on the near side. And the mom said to me, she's like, we were trying this whole love them and everything will work out philosophy, but it just wasn't working. And I just said, for the love of God, we got to do something new. And her husband's a computer designer. He comes up with this idea, and she's very skeptical. She's like, keep your work out of my kitchen. But they implemented it. And the first thing they did was make a morning list. You know, what's going on now is in workplaces, you're seeing these large boards where everyone tracks everyone's progress. That's what they do. So the morning I was there, I mean, you mentioned it opened my book. And it's incredible. Like kid after kid would come down, check the list, make breakfast, check the list again, put the dishes in the dishwasher, check the list again, feed the pets or whatever their job was, check the list and go off to the bus stop. And when I said, look, this will never work in my life. My kids will need much too much monitoring. No way. She's like, that's what I thought. The week we introduced one of these lists into our home, we cut parental screaming in half.
Your girls?
Our girls were 5 at the time.
What?
And they're 8. They went back to school after winter break this morning.
Yeah.
We did it this morning. We're still doing it 3 years later. But here's the key. What's on our list today is totally different than 6 months ago and 6 months before that. We're constantly changing. You know what? We used to start with get dressed. Well, they're 8. We don't have to tell them to get dressed anymore. But we do have to say, you know, drink your milk still. So we change it. We're saying there is a system in place now to accept the fact that there is constant change. So every week we're modifying. In effect, you succeed or fail more quickly, and that allows you to adjust in real time to the complete change that's happening at every given hour.
And then your girls track their own progress or check things off, or how does that work?
Look, you know, if I want to force my kids to do something, or if I want to bribe them or threaten them, the thing that all parents do, I can do that. I can get a short-term reaction. But what flipped in my mind was realizing I actually want them to have the skills to do it when I'm not there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in some ways, that's the judge of parenting, when our children are not in front of us, when we can't helicopter them, as you mentioned earlier, Mike. And what we're doing is we're giving them practice. They don't always do it. It doesn't always succeed, but my wife and I feel like we're laying these underground cables that won't light up their world for many years. We're giving them the skills, and that's what the research shows. You let your children engage in their own setting of responsibilities, and I don't know what motivates them. Let them tell me. This week it turns out they want to sleep over. So fine. You have 5 minutes or fewer of overreacting this week. That's what we're working on this week. You get a sleepover. I might have picked ice cream. Who knows? I might have picked a walk in the park. This is what motivates them. They're beginning to understand and, in effect, take greater responsibility for themselves.
So they pick the rewards, and you also mentioned they pick their punishments. I mean, punishments in quotation marks.
Yeah, look, this week we're working on overreacting, as I just said. And
yeah.
if 5 minutes or fewer, they get a sleepover. More than 10 minutes – no, excuse me. If they have more than 15 minutes of overreacting – or maybe it's 10, I think, this week. More than 10 minutes, they have to do one push-up for every minute over 10. Look, it's petty. It sounds silly. But the point is, that's what motivated them. And guess what? They hit the limit.
All right.
Had push-ups on Sunday afternoon.
We'll talk more in a moment. That's Bruce Feiler. He has written The Secrets of Happy Families. If you have a question for Bruce, call us at 1-888-477-9499. Or if you found something that really works for your family, share it with us. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back with more here on Radio Times.
Abington Health supports WHYY and offers a range of cancer treatment options, including new radiation therapies that fight rare and complex cancers. To learn more about their team approach to cancer care and to view patient stories, abingtonpowertoheal.org.
The Philadelphia Orchestra supports WHYY. Yannick Nezet-Séguin and the Philadelphia Orchestra perform Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, which premiered in Paris a century ago. This centennial is a collaboration with dancers, images projected above the orchestra, and dramatic lighting. Tickets at 215-893-1999. This Thursday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Kimmel Center, The Rite of Spring Centennial with the Philadelphia Orchestra.
Next time in Studio 360, some advice from the country music superstar Dwight Yoakam.
Man can't really steal your field of wheat overnight, but he can sure take a lot of sheep, cattle.
Dwight Yoakam on music, movies, and agriculture. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Well, I'm a honky-tonk man.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
PNC Bank and the Barnes Foundation support WHYY and welcome visitors to experience the Barnes Collection with more than 800 paintings, including masterpieces by Renoir, Matisse, and Picasso. Tickets and details on events and family programs at barnesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane, and we're talking with Bruce Feiler. His new book is The Secrets of Happy Families. Improve Your Mornings, Rethink Family Dinner, Fight Smarter, Go Out and Play, and much more. That's the full title of the book. And Bruce, before our break, you were talking about these checklists that you have implemented in your house. Also, we talked briefly about family meetings. What is the importance of that? What does it do to kind of reduce the chaos and all the angst that happens over the course of the week?
Well, I think that the main thing that it does is create a safe zone. I mean, this is what my wife says. She was skeptical, and what has made her most excited now is that when we're quibbling over the broccoli or fighting over the socks as we did this morning or dealing with something more serious like, you know what, we need to have better manners or be more grateful to our grandparents, we have this safe zone at the end of the week where we know that we don't have to pick the fight in every given moment, we can address it then. And what's so interesting about this is that, you know, like a lot of parents, our children are like Bermuda triangles, right? Thoughts and ideas go in, but we don't often hear things back. This time every week gives us access to their innermost thoughts, and they are incredibly articulate. What's going well? Oh, well, we are greeting more visitors at the door, or we're making our bed the first time. What didn't go well? Our math sheet, or, you know, practicing our piano. And it's fascinating to hear that they understand what's going on, and this gives us a time to address it. And I would say that the other thing that it does is that as parents, we think that we are invincible and we build ourselves up. But the truth is, deep down, we're really afraid. We're afraid that we don't know what we're doing, or worse, that we're doing something ruinously wrong to our children. And by involving our children in the conversation about how is our family working, I mean, it's so rare. We don't talk about our family. I mean, we have our jobs. We work on those. We have our hobbies. We work on those. We have our bodies. We work on those. The family is central to our overall well-being. We spend precious little time talking about how we are, how we function, how we can get better as a family.
And it also seems like it would give the children more of a feeling of investment in making this work well.
Nothing is top down anymore. Not the workplace, not religion, not politics. The family is the last vestige where the parents have all the authority. And I'm not saying it's lax. I want to be very clear. I'm not saying the kids run the asylum. What I'm saying is you have to give children practice developing the skills you want them to have later in life. There is abundant research about this in countless ways. It shows if you engage the children, if they can plan their schedules, if they can decide what motivates them, if they can evaluate themselves. A lot of parents do check marks. One of the simplest things I ask parents these days is, are you doing the checking or are the kids doing the checking? Just a simple thing like making the kids responsible for fessing up as to whether they did it or not. Even that is giving your child practice taking responsibility for themselves, which is what our ultimate goal is as a parent.
In another one of your chapters, you visit a family that has a motto of sorts or has kind of branded their family. This is what we stand for. This is who we are. Talk about that, how that worked out for them.
Well, I think we've been talking about adaptability and change, and I think that's critically important. But there is another side of it, which is there needs to be bedrock at some point. And I talked to Jim Collins, the management guru who wrote Good to Great. And he said to me that successful human organizations of any kind have two things in common. They preserve the core and they stimulate progress. Stimulate progress is what we've just been talking about, how to change, how to adapt, how to fix in real time. But you also need to preserve the core. And he advised us and coached us through this process of doing what a lot of organizations do, which is identify their core mission statement. So he said this all applies to family. So we had the family equivalent of a corporate retreat. We had a pajama party, right? We all got in the bed together. I made popcorn and... But, of course, I burned it, so I made it a second time. And we said, what's most important to us? What do we care about? What do we most want to be known about? Yeah, honesty, Okay, yeah, that's fine. I believe in that in the abstract, but is that one of my, like, five core values? So we came up with a mission statement. Ours is, may your first word be adventure and your last word love. We like adventure, but we also like our family. And then we came up with a list of core statements, like we bring people together. We are travelers, not tourists. We don't like dilemmas. We like solutions. That's a favorite line of my wife's. And research shows, again, Mikan, that one of the best things that you can do is to identify your best possible self. Identify you in the form you most want to be. And what this does is articulate what our core values as a family are. And I have to say, just one quick story, a few weeks after we did this, we got a call from the school that one of our girls had gotten into a spat with a classmate. Okay, and we were like, uh-oh, do we have a mean girl? Like, what are we going to do? And we had never faced this situation. Again, we're not perfect parents. We didn't know what to do. We called my daughter into my office. This mission statement was up on the wall, and my wife, you know, kind of just grasping for straws, said, so, any idea up there seemed to apply. So my daughter looked at the list, and she said, we bring people together? And boom, like suddenly we had a way into the conversation. So here was a difficult moment, and the family mission statement helped all of us, us and her, realize, okay, now we have a framework to have a conversation.
And does it ever feel, when you're doing these things, does it feel, I don't want to say cheesy, but, you know, do you ever get the sense like, oh my goodness, I feel like I'm wearing the t-shirt and I'm at my corporate retreat and I'm doing the rah-rah thing?
Yes, I'm told. I mean, when I first heard this idea of a family mission statement, I'm like, that is so corny, you know? And by the way, everyone said do it in one sentence, and I'm a writer. I'm like, that is a recipe for a long-winded, uninteresting sentence. And frankly, I've read a lot of them that are just like drivel and like, oh, yeah, yeah, so earnest and overbearing. But you know what? I'm kind of corny, and I feel like building a family is corny, you know? I mean, I feel like that's what we're trying to do. And to be honest, if my wife were sitting here next to me, this is what her answer to that question was. I was desperate. You know, I wanted new ideas, and she's in a business, and she realized, you know what, we did this in our business, and we may have thought it was corny, but it really helped. In fact, that was where the idea came from. She's involved in an organization. She does the economic development in emerging markets, and she's like, we went through this process, and it helped us. Why can't it help us? And you know, the question that made me click in my mind to finally say, okay, let's do this corny thing. And by the way, we went the full corny. I mean, we had a flip chart. I mean, the whole thing. Like, we really were doing it corny. Was I thought, you know what? Someone said to me, it's like, how can you ask your children to uphold their values, to uphold your values, if you never tell them what they are?
What they are.
And I was like, I could ask my kids, okay, what do we believe in? And I'd like to think that I'm such a good parent that my kids would tell me. But you know what? I bet they couldn't. And I was like, okay, I'm persuaded. If this works for other people, I'll try it. And if it doesn't work, and we tried a lot of ideas that didn't work in this book. But this really worked.
All right. Well, let's take a call. We have Jessica joining us from West Philadelphia. Hi, Jessica. You are on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm definitely going to use the family meeting structure, so thank you for that. And something I've done with my two children, I have a 5-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son. Since they were very little, I've been doing something I call special time, which is about a half an hour to an hour once a week with each child separately. And it's a time where I don't answer the phone, don't do any work, don't, you know, answer the door or do anything other than follow their lead and do something fun that they want to do. So it might be building Legos with my son and or, you know, doing tag with my daughter. But it really has helped build closeness and make them cooperative with me later on in the day. Sometimes it lasts for many days. I can notice the effect of really spending that time where it's just for them. And sometimes my daughter will test me and she'll want to go to McDonald's. And that's not something I would normally do, but it's her special time. And I find that, you know, building that closeness earlier in the day will make us get along better and have them listen to me more later on.
All right. Thank you so much, Jessica. Bruce, is that something you do with
your
kids?
Kudos to you. And I will I'll be the pointy head person since I read the 200 books of research. I will say that you're dead on the smartest thinking right now. And that is, the research very clearly shows that parents should spend less time worrying about what we do wrong and more time building up what we do right. In other words, so spend less time worrying about the bad times and more time creating positive memories. And that will outweigh the negative ones. And I think that this is a lesson that I keep having to remind myself to remember, and that is all families have conflict, all families have chaos. The most successful families keep it under control and create these alternatives. And there is a section in my book about siblings. And the smartest thinking about siblings is if you want to reduce sibling, say, rivalry or sibling bickering or quarreling at dinner time or long car rides, the places where it's most most acute often, that a couple of things that they say. Number one is give the kids positive time in advance of the mealtime, even 10 minutes to do a shared project reminds them that they can be cooperative. But also exactly what you just said, Jessica, if you spend one-on-one time with that child, it can be 10 minutes a day, it can be 30 minutes a week, whatever works in your schedule, you will reattach and kind of reaffirm that bond that allows them to fight less, that allows you to fight less with them. And by the way, that gives you capital, if you will, when you're pushing them to do their homework or do their sports practice or take a bath or whatever it is you're pushing. The fact that they've remembered they have that bond with you will make even that exchange more successful.
Let's take a question from Kathleen. She's in Chestnut Hill, Bruce, because you bring up the issue of sibling rivalry, and that's something her question addresses. So let's see. Kathleen, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. We wanted to implement family meetings, but how do you go about doing that when you have two teenagers that basically can't stand to be in the same room? We basically have them eating in separate rooms. So.
How old are they, Kathleen?
They're 12 and 16.
And both boys or girls? Or
a boy and a girl.
Okay. Bruce?
Well, I think that, first of all, let me say that I've looked at a lot of families who do the family meeting. The family, you mentioned the Stars earlier in Idaho that I profile in my book, they have four teenagers in very, they're within 5 years of one another. And, we started when we were younger. They deal with that. We deal with some petty things. They deal with things as serious as sexually transmitted diseases. The main thing that I can say is that I will talk about when we first implemented the family meeting system, we made a lot of mistakes. And the biggest mistake that we made was saying, what did you do well this week? And people would say, oh, I had a good play date, or I scored well on my test, or, I had fun at soccer. And it was irrelevant to the rest of us. And I called a lot of people who do this, and the advice I got was, this is not about the individual. This is about how we are functioning as a unit. And it was interesting when I sat in on some family meetings where there were teenagers, there's a lot of stress in their lives. And one of the meetings I witnessed, one of the teenagers said, I had a big test this week, and therefore I literally won't be able to feed the dog on Tuesday. And somebody else stepped up to help that teenager. So I don't know the specific dynamic, but my general advice would be make sure the content of the meeting is not what each of you is doing, but how you are functioning as a family. As I'm constantly saying to my kids, we're in a system. If somebody acts, it affects everybody else, and we need a system in place to deal with that. And that's what this family meeting is. And then, by the way, the other thing that we do is we put the allowance at the end of the meeting, and that incentivizes them to stick around.
All right. So you talk about money at the very end. And Bruce, you got some, thank you so much for that call, Kathleen. And Bruce, you got some advice on fighting better, because fighting is part of family life, let's face it. So who did you
Absolutely.
Talk about how to fight and how not to fight?
We have the 7:42 fight in my house, I call it, where the kids have gone down and my wife would come in, and it was like who's dropping off the dry cleaning, who's picking up the shin guards for soccer, who's taking grandpa to the doctor. And every night, and one night my wife stormed out and I was like, there has to be a better way. And 2 weeks later, I took a 3-day course from the folks at the Harvard Negotiation Project, right? These people deal with Israeli-Palestinian peace talks and the Northern Irish and the Irish and general strikes. And I figured they can help me deal with whether we should serve pizza or pretzel at my daughter's birthday party. And I learned a couple things. The first thing I learned is when. There's a tremendous amount of research that 6 to 8, I don't need the research to tell me this, by the way, but research that's the worst time of the day. Everyone's coming home. Everyone needs to get fed. There's a lot of stress. So 7:42 at night, worst time to have this fight. Also, where? I talked to these environmental psychologists, and it turns out that we were doing this in my office. I was high at my desk. There's my computer equipment. my wife was in this old IKEA chair that was like a foot lower, and she was incredibly resentful that I was in the power position. So we've now moved. The research shows if you're at the same level, the conversation will go better. Or when we have difficult ones, we actually now move to this window seat in our bedroom because it's got a cushion, and there's fascinating research that I looked at that if you're on a rigid surface or at a hard table, you'll be more rigid. If you're on a cushioned surface, you'll be more cushioned. You'll be more open and accommodating. But the general thing I learned, we kind of use a watered-down technique of the Harvard Project with our girls, and there are basically three steps. One is when the fight gets acute, to separate everybody. In negotiation speak, this is go to the balcony, take a timeout, look back on the stage and kind of realize where you were. Then we even ask our kids, and my wife and I do it too, of course, come up with alternatives. Each person has to come up with three alternatives. Okay, once there are five or six or seven alternatives on the table, then the third step, which is picking a solution, usually isn't that hard. The hardest thing is to break out of your fixed position, look at alternatives, and usually with the kids, a solution, the same solution will be on both lists, or even with us, once we break out of our positions. As the head of the Harvard Negotiation Project told me, in the old days, and we talked about this, Mike, and in the old days, there was no debate about, it was clear, dad did this, mom did that. Those rules no longer apply. We are, he said, the first generation that is in constant negotiation. We're all pioneers, he said, and once you realize that, you relax, and it makes the negotiation that much easier.
When you're in the middle of a fight, who takes the role of the who takes the role of the kind of referee to say, "Go to the balcony, Bruce"?
Well, that's
emotional.
Different from referee,
right? Right. But who takes that role of breaking it up?
Well, if it's me and my wife, usually one of us will now do it. Okay, anybody can call for a 5-minute timeout at any time. That's rule number one. Our kids are learning that it's slow. They're just about to be 8. But sometimes we will come in, and rather than refereeing, we say, okay, we're going to separate. Okay, once we separate, we go through this. Remember what we do, you know, remember, this is what we've agreed to work on. We're going to come up with alternatives. Then we bring them back together, and by that point, there is a solution that's easier. Or, this was just described in USA Today, the reporter comes over to write a book about our family, and our kids broke into a squabble right in front of the reporter. And he described all this in USA Today the other day. It's like, what happens when the author of The Secrets of Happy Families has some unhappiness? But then they brought it up in the family meeting. Again, there's a safe zone. We know if it gets really out of control, we have a 20-minute meeting coming up where everybody is calm and everybody has to have that conversation, and no one can leave until we work out a solution.
Is it hard to break that pattern? Because sometimes, let's face it, we somehow enjoy those, or maybe not enjoy outwardly, but there's something about fighting that is a certain pattern and we follow it and it's habitual.
Oh my God, I'm totally that way. Sometimes my wife will sue for peace too quickly. And I'm like, wait a minute, I have 7 more points to make. I don't want to resolve this argument. And it's interesting, there is research that women will often resolve fights too quickly, leaving themselves frustrated later, and then that they regret it. The goal is not to solve the problem. The goal is actually to remember, you're going to come back. There's going to be another one. One of the reasons that the family members fight, the research shows, is because we take one another for granted. So we need this larger system. Yeah, we enjoy it, but we got to come up with a way to make sure it doesn't cripple us.
All right, that's Bruce Feiler. He has written The Secrets of Happy Families. We'll be right back after a short break, and we'll also take more calls at 1-888-477-9499. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and this is Radio Times here on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
If your child is being bullied on social media sites by schoolmates, when is it appropriate for you or the school to intervene? That's one of the questions we'll discuss on the next Fresh Air with Emily Bazelon, author of Sticks and Stones, about the culture of bullying and efforts to stop it. Her research took her to homes, schools, courtrooms, and the offices of Facebook. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. 50 years after Betty Friedan published The Feminine Mystique, family historian Stephanie Kuntz asks why both men and women can't get what they really want. Also, Kelly Willis and Bruce Robison and their modern take on classic country music, they seem happy. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain. Our guest is Bruce Feiler. His new book is The Secrets of Happy Families. Bruce, let's go right to the phones at 1-888-477-9499. We have Jean joining us from Cinnaminson. Hi, Jean. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. As an uncle who spent a lot of time with 8 nieces and nephews as they were growing up, I feel I had a unique perspective into the question of lying, because it's some of my siblings tended to take the theory that they assumed that their kids were telling the truth almost all the time, and being closer to the kids, having a different kind of relationship, I knew who was lying and who wasn't, and it seemed to me that those parents, the parents who trusted the kids the most, had the kids who lied the most. And some of them kept that habit, right, you know, into adulthood. And I was wondering what your theory on handling this subject was and how important you felt it was.
Thank you, Gene, for that call. Bruce, what's your take on lying?
You know, there's different views about lying, actually. One is the view that you mentioned, which is lying is unacceptable in all circumstances. There is this rival view that's been gaining currency recently in the literature and in this conversation, that lying is, you know, is practicing imagination, and it's not necessarily such an awful thing. It's not something that I tackled directly in the Secrets of Happy Families. I'm interested in your idea that permissiveness in general tended to foster this. I mean, I'm definitely talking in general here, I would say, about this idea of engaging. I think that there is definitely what's happening in the world of family space, the larger space. You mentioned I write this column in the New York Times about this, and one of the things that's striking to me time and again is how important family has come. And I think that the idea of sort of whatever, let whatever goes, you know, kind of total permissiveness, as you said, that is really not what's current right now. If anything, we have the opposite problem. Working parents today spend more time with their children than non-working parents did a generation ago. And fathers in particular are spending abundant more time. And in general, I would say, pivoting away from lying, whether it's sexuality, you know, the more intimate and more close parents are with their children's lives, that delays the onset of sexuality. With financial responsibility, we see when parents avoid the topic, think, oh, you know, I'm not going to talk about it, that fosters irresponsibility. The more the parents engage the children on understanding where money comes from, how it's spent, how children should spend it, giving them practice, the more children learn. So I would say that my instinct and what I'm taking from the literature is that the more parents engage, the more they talk. One of my three big themes about families is they talk a lot. I would say the more parents engage, the more they are actively spreading the values they want their children to have.
That's another place, I guess, where the family motto and branding could come in handy, because if kids know what the expectations are and kind of buy into that, then they might actually do it.
Let's just take something that's related to this that I was completely guilty of being a bumbling dad at, and that is sexuality. I think I took the position of, I have young girls, I'm going to wait until they get older. Oh, I'll deal with the birds and the bees, and I'll have the talk when they get later. Boy, was I schooled that was the wrong approach. Even when I was giving my children a bath, I would say, you know, wash your privates or wash down there. And then I read the study that 5-year-old boys, that the majority, the boys and girls know that boys have penises and girls have down there. And I was like, oh, yeah, guilty as charged. Even the simple joking about, oh, if you want to date my daughter, I did this all the time. You got to come through your dad with a shotgun. You know, that even that is stigmatizing sexuality. That even the American Pediatric Association said as early as 18 months old, you should be having age-appropriate conversation with children about body parts and sexuality. And the truth is, it's much easier to talk to them when they're younger, because when they get 12, 13, 14, they're tuning us out. And I spent this night, as you know, because it's in my book, with this swim team of girls, and they were kind of reining me and schooling me about all this. And they said to me, and it's one of my favorite lines in the whole book, it's not the talk anymore. It's a series of talks. It's a conversation. And to me, that applies to so many realms of parenting, is you have to have an ongoing conversation, because the truth is we think they're going to learn it in the internet or they're going to learn it from elsewhere, but there's so much misinformation out there. They need the actual facts from us.
All right, let's take another call. We have Meredith joining us from Ardmore. Hi, Meredith. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm a new stepmom, and I had a question about how would you go about creating shared family values in a step family while being mindful that the children's other families may have very different views in their other parents' home than we have in ours?
That's a great question, Meredith. And Bruce, that's something a lot of American families face, is blended families and all different kind of structures.
Well, one of the fascinating things that's happening in the world today is that the definition of the family has changed so much. We have adoptive families, step families, blended families. We have nuclear families that live in separate houses, divorce families that nest in the same house. Lots of change going on, and yet the family is powerfully important. In fact, 8 in 10 people today say that the family they have now is as close or closer than the family they grew up in. So my response to that is, first of all, you know, good on you, as we say in the South, right? Good on you for wanting to address this. And I think that the frustration and concern that you have, everything that I have read has taught me to be much more open with my children. So I can see a situation where you're sitting calmly, equally, you know, in whatever circumstance, in the bed, on the floor, in the car, wherever it is, in which you say, look, I'm respectful of the fact that you have, that your mom is your mom and I'm your stepmom, but you're spending a percentage of your time in our family, and this is what's important to us. It may not be what's important to your mom, but we need to together come up with a set of rules. And then you engage, in which you say, this is what's really important to us. So I think this idea of a mission statement, maybe it's our step family's mission statement. Maybe it's, these are the rules that apply here. One of the things that I'm saying, one of the things that I learned, one of the things that's a hallmark of my book is, it's not one size fits all anymore. It's have a conversation, co-create your family with your children. And in this case, you're in effect compelled to do it, but in an ironic way, you're much freer than people with nuclear family, because it's obvious you're not in total control. And it's obvious what your rules don't apply to the other family, but that's going to free you up to be much more honest, which in the long run is going to really serve you with your stepchildren.
All right, Meredith, thank you so much for that call. And Bruce, earlier on, you brought up the issue of financial responsibility and learning about that. Also brought up the topic of allowances earlier. Who did you ask advice from on that topic? It's also very important.
Well, this is, interestingly enough, one of it's a little bit surprising to me, people's favorite chapter in The Secrets of Happy Families. I went to the people who deal with the richest families in the country, financial advisors. Warren Buffett's banker was kind enough to spend time with me. And I figured, okay, he literally deals with the 100 richest families in the country. And I figured they're better at it. And he was like, no, in fact, the opposite. And he gave me some striking advice that really surprised me. Number one, show them the money. Actually, be much more honest with your children about money, where it's made, how it's spent, the concerns that you have. If you show your, you know, we think we don't need to talk about it, but the truth is 80% of kids get to college never having had a conversation about credit with their families. Where are they going to learn those skills? He said, I told the richest woman in America, you should show your kids. She's like, I don't want to burden them. He's like, it's much better to burden them with the truth than to burden them with ignorance. And he chided me about one thing, Mike, and he said, we give our kids, you know, my research before we did this with our kids, we divide things into four pots: spend, share, give away. Save, spend, give away. And we also have a share pot, which is a pot that we have to decide together. We do one, after all my research, we do $1 for every age of the child. So my kids will be 8 soon. They'll get $8. Then they divide it. And we were forcing them to divide it equally. And he chided me. He was like, let them make their own decisions. And I was like, but what if they drive into a ditch? And he gave me, again, this is one of my favorite lines in the book. He said, it's much better to drive into a ditch with a $6 allowance than a $60,000 a year salary or a $6 million inheritance. And I was like, boy, does that make sense. And to me, that's my motto for the whole thing. Get your kids involved. Let them practice the skills you want them to have. If you could force a solution on them, but it's not serving them or ultimately you well.
Let's take another call. We have Christine joining us from Salem County, New Jersey. Hi, Christine. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. When I was growing up on long car trips, there were three of us sisters in a small back seat, and my mother got my sisters to sing songs together, and it kept them from fighting. And not only that, I learned a lot of wonderful songs. It gave us a real firm love of music, and we learned some of our family's folk songs, our family heritage. My mother was from Germany, and just gave us a lot of good memories. And other things that I was thinking of when you were talking just now, my mother had a phrase that if my sisters brought up something or I said, well, what about so-and-so does it? Their family does it. Mm-hmm. It would be, well, we don't do that. And I remember hearing that more than once. But something else my mom did, she never let us go to sleep angry at her or my father. There was always, at the end of the day, when you went to bed, if you went in there and you hadn't really reconnected with her, she would come in and sit down and talk to us.
All right, Christine, thank you so
much. And I think that was really, really important.
Thank you, Christine, so much. It sounds like your mother was a wonderful lady, or is. And Bruce, something that
Christine... Oh, Christine, you made my day. You just made my day. I was looking at this clock and thinking, am I going to get through this whole hour without mentioning my favorite thing?
So, which is?
Pull over, get a pencil. If you learn one thing from The Secrets of Happy Families, learn this. First of all, there's a whole chapter in my book about new games for cars, because I was tired of playing 20 questions and I went to Zynga, the online game designers. But one of my favorite things I learned in the entire process of working on this book, Mike, and it's in my chapter on family dinner, which is about don't worry about family dinner. You know, you can do it at family breakfast. You can do it in a car ride. There's only 10 minutes of meaningful time. You can move it to any type of the day. Don't feel guilty. And one of the things you can do is researchers at Emory gave kids a simple do you know test. Do you know your family heritage? Do you know where your grandparents were born? Do you know where your parents went to high school? Do you know somebody in your family who had a great success? Do you know someone who had a great failure and how they overcame it? And the children who scored highest on the do you know test had a higher sense of self-esteem and a greater sense of confidence that they could control their lives. The do you know test was the single biggest predictor of emotional health and happiness. And as the study's author, who I quote extensively in my book, said to me, children who understand that they're part of a longer narrative, if you tell your family history, it'll give them confidence, because you want to tell, these were our positive moments, and yes, these were our negative moments, and this is how we overcame them. That will give your children the confidence to overcome their own difficult moments.
That's great advice. And let's take another quick call from Jayshari, who is joining us from Delaware. Hi, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm part of an extended East Indian family, and we all live close to one another. I have my own children, and my brother-in-law's family is close by, my in-law's family is close by, and there's a lot of interaction. How do you deal with, or how do you recommend dealing with interactions with your extended family when, you know, your in-laws are of a different generation, of a different country, and their ideas about child rearing are different from your ideas about your children's child rearing?
I'm sure that's a question that affects a lot of families. Bruce, what's your advice?
Well, quickly, let me just say, there's a whole chapter in my book on grandparenting, and you know, one of my rules is, you know, grandparent my children, don't parent them. You know, parents get to parent their children. Grandparents can express their advice, but they can't be upset if you don't follow it. There is the final chapter of The Secrets of Happy Families is called Give War a Chance. And I was asking this question about extended reunions. We have them in the summer in both halves of my family, my wife's and my own. And I was like, who's better at bringing people of different cultures together than the military. And I went to work with some Green Berets and talked to people at the Pentagon and got this whole set of tips. And there, what we would happen is everyone would retreat to their own families, kind of maybe what I'm hearing from yours. And their advice to me was to bring everybody together, kind of make teams, get people of different generations and families working together. Nothing makes an us better than a them. And so if you have, you know, some competition, you have different families together, maybe a cheer, maybe some chant, maybe some competition. It could be a volleyball game. It could be a, you know, we have these made-up games, you know, Cape House Challenge that we do with my wife's family, and my family puts on a play. But if you force people of different cultures together on a team, they will have that memorable experience. It's like we were saying about siblings earlier. You want to make sure you have enough positive memories to balance off the inevitable conflict. So anything you can do, playing, games, competition, sports, family trivia contests, bake-offs, whatever it is that your family likes doing, if you divide people up, force them together, that will make positive glue that will help you when inevitably the differences arise.
And Bruce, we have about, thank you for that call, Jay Shari. And Bruce, we have about a minute left. And in the beginning of your book, you have a quote from Tolstoy and says, "All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way." So what are, in your mind, the hallmarks of happy families, if you can sum it up in about a minute?
I would say, first of all, I used to think that line was inane, but now I think it's true. And my research says, in the 3 years I've spent doing this, they adapt all the time, they talk a lot, they go out and play. And the last thing they do is they work on it. What's the secret of a happy family? Take small steps, accumulate small wins, just try. Your family will be happier.
And it's a work in process.
Exactly. You don't need a big plan. You don't need a super duper solution. You just have to agree to work on it. Take small steps. We don't work on it. If we work on our families, they'll be happier and the individuals will be happier.
That's Bruce Feiler. Thank you so much for joining us, Bruce, on Radio Times today.
Thank you, Mike, and what a thrill.
All right, and he has written The Secrets of Happy Families. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Our engineer has been Fred Snyder. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain. Thank you so much for joining us today.